Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Alex Lawson, Executive Director of Social Security Works, who examines President Trump's proposed federal budget and its call for deep cuts in the nation's Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid programs. Ron Fine, legal director with the group Free Speech for People, who assesses the mounting evidence that Donald Trump has likely committed high crimes and misdemeanors, warranting impeachment. And human rights and union organizer Cleve Jones, who shares the lessons he's learned fighting for social justice during his 45 years of activism for LGBTQ rights and against AIDS. But first we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Along the 500-mile frontier between Ethiopia and Eritrea in East Africa, border guards are a welcome sign for refugees fleeing torture and illegal imprisonment. For 25 years, Ethiopia has had an open-door policy for refugees and asylum seekers fleeing war-torn nations like Somalia, Sudan, and South Sudan. Ethiopia and Eritrea fought a brief but brutal war between 1998 and 2000, which disrupted long-standing ethnic ties and trade. Over 165,000 Eritrean refugees have fled to Ethiopia. People in both nations share a common ethnic heritage, the same language, and they practice the same religion. Eritreans have fled their country for a number of reasons, including enforced indefinite military service, illegal imprisonment, and torture. Upon arrival and registration, they are automatically granted refugee status, and in contrast to the way Europe treats refugees, the country continues its open-door policy. Ethiopia recently signed an agreement with Britain, the European Union, and the World Bank to build two industrial parks that will employ 100,000 people. As part of the deal, Ethiopia will grant employment rights to 30,000 refugees residing in the country. The U.S. Department of Homeland Security has granted a 6-month extension of temporary protected status to over 50,000 Haitians living in the United States. This temporary protection shields them from deportation and permits the Haitians to seek employment. U.S. Homeland Security Secretary John Kelly granted only a short-term extension in light of improved economic conditions in Haiti. Kelly maintains that extending protected status to the Haitians will give them time to obtain the necessary travel documents to return to Haiti. Protective status for Haitians was originally granted after the massive earthquake in 2000 that killed 200,000 people. More recently, 9,000 Haitians died in a cholera epidemic, and last fall, Hurricane Matthew destroyed crops and livestock on that island nation. Despite the continuing hardship faced by millions of Haitians, President Trump has called for a $33 million reduction in U.S. foreign aid to Haiti. The Trump administration's ruling on Haitians is seen as a bellwether for migrants living in the U.S. from other nations who are also under temporary protected status, including 200,000 residents from El Salvador, Honduras, and Nicaragua. The Trump White House recently allowed the protected status for nationals from the West African nations of Liberia, Guinea, and Sierra Leone to expire. Soon after President Trump was sworn into office, there was grave concern that his administration would initiate a massive sell-off of public lands in Western states, in an unprecedented giveaway to loggers, miners, and other natural resources extraction industries. But the Trump White House and its allies ran into resistance from people like Idaho rancher Merrill Baylor, who wants the U.S. Forest Service and Bureau of Land Management to continue to be in charge of public lands. Utah Congressman Jason Chaffetz introduced a bill to sell off 3 million acres of public lands in Western states, but the proposal was quickly withdrawn due to strong local opposition among environmentalists as well as hunters and fishermen. Salmon, Idaho, is 150 miles from an interstate or a big box store. The area is rural and pristine, and a place where ranchers and residents regularly argue over the proper way to manage public lands. These conflicts have led to various uprisings, including the Wise Use movement of the 1980s. Western land disputes have also provoked extreme opposition from armed militia groups. Last year, simmering frustrations culminated in the occupation of the Malheur National Wildlife Refuge in Oregon by armed ranchers led by Ammon Bundy and Ryan Bundy. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Leslie Rudden.
During his presidential election campaign, Donald Trump repeatedly stated that if elected, he wouldn't make cuts to Social Security, Medicare, or the Medicaid program. The real estate billionaire often differentiated himself from his Republican opponents during the primary campaign, pointing out that he alone was the candidate who wouldn't touch social safety net programs, declaring it's not fair to the people who have been paying into the system for years. But now that he's in office, it appears that Trump's campaign pledge to protect Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid was worth about as much as a degree from Trump University. The president's first federal budget includes massive reductions in funding for Medicaid, Social Security, and other social programs. Proposed cuts include $800 billion less for Medicaid over the next 10 years, which the Congressional Budget Office has estimated would slash benefits for 10 million low-income people. The budget also calls for giving states more power to stiffen work requirements for people living below the poverty line who receive federal assistance, which could tighten the limits on who can access benefits and for how long. In addition, Trump's budget asks for a $72.5 billion cut in spending over the next decade on the disabled, by decreasing spending on Social Security disability insurance, which has been administered by the Social Security Administration since 1956. Your reporter spoke with Alex Lawson, executive director of the group Social Security Works, who examines President Trump's proposed federal budget and how it will impact Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid.
During the campaign, he vociferously stated that he was not going to cut any of those three programs. And in fact, in his plans, he cuts all three of them. So starting with Medicaid, because his plan there is just to destroy Medicaid. You have $880 billion that are coming out with Trump Care, and on top of that, hundreds of billions of dollars more in his budget. He's not aiming at rolling back the expansion of Medicaid, and the corporate media has been very sloppy about this. They make it seem like maybe that's what they're talking about. No, this is ending Medicaid. Medicaid, which is the largest provider of long-term care in America, and for the vast majority of people, the only provider of long-term care. That's both in-home care and nursing home care, the average cost of which is $93,000 per year. And this would just get rid of that. And you know what everyone would be left with? Nothing. That's the plan. They don't replace it with anything. They just get rid of Medicaid. Medicare, he has billions, tens of billions of dollars of cuts in Medicaid, plus removes dedicated financing that came in with Obamacare, which leads him to tee it up, and Paul Ryan's been very clear about this, so that they could come back after they caused the problem and say, oh, woe is me, I didn't want to do it, but we're going to just have to turn over Medicare to my criminal friends in the insurance industry. That's the tried and true tactic of the Republicans, kneecap the mailman and then complain that the mail is late, which they do against the post office. And then finally, very brazenly, the budget also just cuts $72 billion out of Social Security. And the brazenness with it is in their press release, they just say, we don't cut Social Security. And then right there in the budget, you can circle the lines where they do cut Social Security. So this is a guy who lies about everything, big and small, and the people need to understand. They have to do their homework to see what they're actually planning. And what they're planning is to steal our money, to steal our health, to give it to their criminal friends on Wall Street, and to make off in a big payday in the largest tax handout to billionaires that's ever been envisioned.
Alex, all this is quite alarming, given the fact that Republicans control the executive branch in Donald Trump and the White House and both branches of the U.S. Congress. So it is certainly within the realm of possibility that the Republicans could carry out these very dramatic and deep cuts and decimate the nation's already weak social safety net. What can you tell us about the opposition that's out there to what we're seeing unfold? And I would ask you first to talk about opposition among Republicans who are already more than a little concerned about their prospects for re-election, given all that's happened in the Trump White House with scandal after scandal and his rising on popularity.
Yeah, it's a great point, because you have to clearly state the danger. And I think that that's just critical, that people understand this is their aspiration. If they had all the power, this is what they'd do. So that's their goal. Now, can they get to their goal is a different question, because that's where you get into political power. You only need to flip three Republican senators because of a process called reconciliation that they're going to use to try to get Trump care through. They only need a majority. So if we can find three Republican senators who will vote no on any reconciliation bill that includes Medicare or Medicaid, we can block it. If you are represented by Republican senators, just make phone calls. Show up at town halls. They're cowards, so they're not having town halls. So host a town hall with a Democrat from nearby. Go onto social media. Basically make a ruckus. And the time to make that ruckus is now.
That was Alex Lawson, executive director of the group Social Security Works. Find more analysis and commentary on the Trump GOP plan to gut the nation's social safety net programs by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. While Donald Trump was in the midst of his first overseas trip as president, another explosive news report was published, casting an ever-darkening shadow over his administration in office for just over 120 days. On May 26, the Washington Post broke the story that Trump's senior advisor and son-in-law, Jared Kushner, had proposed setting up a back channel between the Trump transition team and Moscow, using Russia's secure cyber equipment at either Moscow's embassy or consulate. The paper said that Russian Ambassador Sergei Kislyak had reported to his superiors that Kushner made the unusual proposal during a meeting with him on either December 1st or 2nd at Trump Tower, according to intercepts of Russian communications that were reviewed by U.S. intelligence agencies. This new information regarding covert communication between Trump staff and Russian officials, designed to be concealed from FBI-NSA surveillance, underscored the more serious unproven allegation that the Trump campaign had colluded with Moscow to influence the outcome of the 2016 U.S. presidential election. Trump's own actions firing FBI Director James Comey and asking two senior intelligence agency officials to publicly deny the existence of any evidence of coordination between Trump and Moscow has only added fuel to the fire regarding obstruction of justice charges now being investigated by Special Counsel Robert Mueller. Your reporter spoke with Ron Fine, legal director with the group Free Speech for People, which is circulating a petition advocating the impeachment of Donald Trump that has already collected more than 1 million signatures. Here, Fine assesses the mounting evidence that Trump has likely committed high crimes and misdemeanors, requiring the GOP-controlled House of Representatives to launch an impeachment investigation.
Yeah, we've got at this point over 1.12 million signers, which is incredible in a period of 4 months. For people to join this movement so quickly. And what this is calling upon is asking the House of Representatives in Congress to launch an impeachment investigation. And the way that works is that the Judiciary Committee of the House would conduct an investigation into whether there are grounds for impeachment. And we lay out the specifics of what we think they ought to be investigating. And that would be the first step in the impeachment process.
I have read that one congressional representative, Al Green, a Democrat of Texas, has actually started the ball rolling on impeachment. I'm not sure if he's been joined by others as yet. But Ron, tell us a little bit about Representative Al Green and what's happening there with the actual the levers and gears in Congress to get this impeachment thing rolling.
So Representative Green gave a very powerful speech on the House floor where he talked about one of the various grounds for impeachment that we've identified on our website, which is obstruction of justice, and how his threshold had been reached. He was ready, because impeachment is a process that should not be taken lightly. It's a very serious process that, you know, shouldn't be used for light or political purposes, even though it is a somewhat political process by nature. And Representative Green is the first one to take a stand and say that we are ready now to begin this process. And he is working, with us, in fact, on developing the next steps for what to do in the House. Other members of the House of Representatives have talked about impeachment as well. And we think that what will happen is it will take a little bit of time before a large mass comes along, but that the president continues to supply additional reasons and additional grounds. When we started this impeachment campaign, we were talking entirely at that point about the president's violations of anti-corruption provisions of the Constitution. When he began his obstruction of justice, that added a whole new dimension to it, and I think that is really what's going to help drive this movement forward.
Ron, run down for our listeners what you feel are the most important grounds for impeachment that would stand the test that they're surely going to meet in the Republican-controlled House. And among those three reasons that I'm aware of, and you've run down a couple of them, is obstruction of justice, violation of the constitutional provision on emoluments, as well as the very real questions about collusion between the Trump campaign and the Russian government in an effort to influence the outcome of the 2016 U.S. presidential election.
So what we have focused on are two categories of offenses where we know that they are impeachable high crimes and misdemeanors, and where the evidence is already solid, where we don't have to wait for extensive additional factual development in order to begin that impeachment process. And so the two categories that we've identified, one are the corruption clauses of the Constitution, and there are two. One called the Foreign Emoluments Clause prohibits any federal government official from taking payments from foreign governments without permission from Congress, and the president has been violating that since day one through his businesses. There's also the Domestic Emoluments Clause, lesser known, that only applies to the president and prohibits him from enriching himself from the federal treasury beyond the salary that he gets. That's the first category. The second category is obstruction of justice, and that has been that was one of the articles of impeachment against Richard Nixon, and it's a very serious offense that that the president is in a special position to commit because he is, in essence, the head of the executive branch that conducts investigations and does law enforcement, and that's why it's such a great offense against the state when the president is interfering with ongoing investigations.
That was Ron Fine, legal director with the group Free Speech for People. Find links to the group's impeachment petition and related articles by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. A man who was instrumental in the fight for gay rights in the 1970s, in the fight against AIDS in the 1980s and 90s, has been working ceaselessly since then for justice for workers and everyone else. While still in high school, Cleve Jones was electrified by a story he read in Life magazine in 1971 about gay liberation. After high school, he found a mentor in Harvey Milk, an out gay man and a member of the San Francisco Board of Supervisors. Jones now works for the Unite Here International Union, promoting equal rights for LGBTQ workers and others. The union represents workers in the hospitality industry, transportation, textile manufacturing, and more. He spoke on May 21st at Yale University, whose workers are represented by Unite Here, about lessons learned over his 45-year career in organizing. He spoke in support of Yale graduate student teachers, who are now fighting an intransigent Yale administration to negotiate a contract after they won a union vote in February. In his talk, Jones shared the lessons he's learned, which included the importance of building coalitions and of strategically and relentlessly using a variety of tactics in pursuit of one's goals, such as conducting voter registration drives, organizing protest marches, and engaging in nonviolent civil disobedience actions.
Meeting Harvey Milk was really the single most important thing that ever happened to me in my entire life. I was going to high school in Phoenix in the late 60s and early 1970s, and I had already joined the movement. The war in Vietnam began the year I was born, in 1954. And when I graduated from high school, it was still raging, and young people of all races and backgrounds united in an effort to end that illegal and immoral war. During that same period, Cesar Chavez came to Arizona to organize the workers in the fields, and my friends and I who'd been protesting the war joined that struggle. It took a little while for word of the women's liberation movement to trickle down to Maricopa County, but when we heard about it, we signed up and we circulated petitions for the Equal Rights Amendment, and we understood that this was yet another part of that larger global effort for peace and for social justice, the fight against war and against racism and poverty. But I didn't know that any part of the movement was for me. I just knew that I was different in a way that was dangerous and really scary. And that danger and fear was made evident to me every single day when I went to high school. I thought my life was over before it even began. When I was 15, I was so frightened about what it meant to be queer that I started stealing pills from my parents until I had quite the stockpile, because I knew at some point people were going to understand what I was, and the only way out was to kill myself. And I think you all know there are still 15-year-olds out there right now that are stealing those pills and getting ready to kill themselves. But I read that article in Life magazine, and I flushed the pills down the toilet, and I hitchhiked to San Francisco. And I met Harvey Milk, and I went to work for him. And then I found his body on the floor. And I thought, well, it's over now. We were trapped in the office for hours as the police bundled up the bodies, and all I could think was, it's over. It's over. He was our leader. He was my mentor. He was like a father figure to me. And it was all over. And then the sun went down, and the people began to gather at Castro and Market Street and lit their candles, gay and straight, young and old, black and brown and white, immigrant and native born, and they marched in that river of candles that I know you've seen in the films, down to Civic Center Plaza and filled the plaza with the light of candles, and I stood in that crowd and I knew it wasn't over. It was just beginning. Yeah. Out of that tragedy, we built power. We united people. And we were led by Harvey's example, who told us two things. He said, you must come out and reveal who you are and the true nature, your true nature, to your colleagues, your coworkers, your friends, your families, because then they won't hate you anymore, and they won't fear you anymore, and they won't vote to take away your rights. And he also taught us to build coalitions, to reach out to the labor movement, to the women's movement, to ethnic and racial communities, to environmentalists, to all of us. He called it the coalition of the usses. And despite his death, we grew in power. And then AIDS came. By 1985, almost everyone I knew was dead or dying or home caring for someone who was dying. And my friends and I thought, well, now it is over. We're not going to survive this. How can the movement be sustained when half of us are already dead. In my little neighborhood, we'd lost 1,000 people just by the fall of 1985. By the time treatment arrived, over 25,000 gay men in my neighborhood had been killed. And I thought it was over. But we acted up, and we sewed quilts, and we lit candles, and we stormed the FDA and the NIH, and we said, no, we want resources, we want research, we want compassion, and we want action. We had a president at the time who has since been elevated to sainthood in some quarters. His name was Reagan. He didn't say the word AIDS publicly until more Americans had died of AIDS than died in the entire Vietnam War. And we fought him, and we fought Bush, and we fought Clinton. And just when I was ready to die and couldn't walk and was losing my vision, the first medications were released. It wasn't over. I lived. Now, this past November, my boyfriend was in Washington on business. He's younger than me. We text a lot. I'm sitting alone in my apartment watching the results come in. Florida. I thought, oh no, and I'm texting him, he's texting back, don't worry, it's gonna be okay, it's gonna be okay. We're gonna win. And then the results came in from Pennsylvania, and I was so upset, and I called him on the phone. I said, it's over, we're gonna lose. He said, honey, you just went from zero to Auschwitz in like 1 minute, calm down. Are you alone in the apartment? I said, yeah, and he said, go down to the street, go down to Castro Street, start the march. And I went down to the street, and that night we marched, tens of thousands of people, gay and straight, young and old, men and women, black and brown and white, immigrant and native born. We marched and we said, no, this isn't over. This is just beginning.
That was Cleve Jones, human rights activist, Unite Here union organizer, and author of the book When We Rise, My Life in the Movement, speaking at Yale University on May 21st. This segment was recorded and produced by Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus. For more information on Cleve Jones and the union struggle at Yale University, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio, and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on WRFI in Ithaca, New York, WDRT in Viroqua, Wisconsin, FRSC in Santa Cruz, California, and more than 50 other community stations across the U.S. and abroad. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Leslie Rudden, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.